Today in Studio 360, a romantic comedy that isn't conventionally romantic or comedic.
You get so mad at me.
Oh, my gosh.
I feel like you want to kill me.
I do want to kill you.
How would you do it?
Oh, no. I poison you. I poison your cupcakes.
For his new film, This Is 40, Judd Apatow wanted to make a funny movie that felt like his real life. And not just by casting his actual wife as the wife.
It's not autobiographical in that sense, but it's emotionally accurate. It's everything we're struggling with, and we found a way to turn it into a story. I'ma
take your grandpa style. I'ma take your grandpa style. And hip-hop, no, for real. It's getting real, too, in a new way. I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. Thrift shopping and gay marriage promoting with Macklemore. That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
From PRI and WNYC, this is Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson.
And that's the rapper Macklemore, who I'll talk with on today's show about the unlikely song that's just helped make him a star. By promoting gay rights and marriage equality.
If I was gay, I would think hip-hop hates me. Have you read the YouTube comments lately? Man, that's gay, gets dropped on the daily. We become so numb to what we're saying. A culture founded from oppression.
The rapper Macklemore joins me later this hour. But first, let's talk about literature in schools. Because right now, a lot of English teachers and other humanities types are afraid that classic works of fiction are about to lose ground big time to nonfiction, replaced in American classrooms by historical documents, newspaper articles, even instructional manuals. That fear is in reaction to the Common Core State Standards, which are the new national curriculum for K-12 education that's been adopted by almost every state in the country. There have been worried articles in the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, USA Today, and This Week in Time magazine. And a lot of the backlash against the Common Core standards gets directed at David Coleman. He's one of the Core Standards authors, as well as America's new standardized test czar as president of the College Board. David Coleman, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much.
So, it seems like most of the anxiety that teachers and other people are feeling and expressing about the Common Core standards seems to be coming from one recommendation in particular, that by the end of high school, 70% of what students are supposed to read should be nonfiction. Are they misunderstanding what the core standards are?
Yes, there is a misunderstanding. The standards are absolutely clear on the central role that fiction plays and continues to play in the English language arts classroom. So I will quote directly from page 5 of the standards. It says, teachers of senior English classes, for example, are not required to devote 70% of reading to informational texts. Instead, what the standards say is the majority of time in the English language arts class, and the majority of attention remains fiction, high-quality fiction, drama, literature, narrative fiction, and poems. The only thing that changes in English language arts is that there's some portion of time spent on high-quality literary nonfiction of the sort that our founding documents are, as well as the great conversation that happens as a result of that discussion in our country. The facts are so clear, and it's in black and white in the standards several times. I think that as we better communicate, teachers were crucial to developing these standards, and they'll be crucial in telling the story, and we should work with them to get the message out.
It seems to me one of the sources of the miscommunication, to the degree it's that, is that it's in black and white for the first time, there's on a chart, it says 70% reading will be about work that persuades or explains, and 30% will be literature. So is it your view and the hope of the core standards that at the end of 12th grade, a kid will, in fact, not have read less fiction than she or he would have 10 years ago, but would simply read more?
Would read would read probably higher quality, I would dare say high quality or more rigorous fiction than it is likely they have read before, because these standards build a staircase of increasingly demanding text over the years, because what our research shows, what the overwhelming finding of research, is that kids are often reading at about 4 grade levels behind what they need to be ready for college and career. And that's true of their literary reading, you know, of what they read in literature. It's true of what they read in literary nonfiction. It's true of their science classroom. So there's a general call in these standards to raise the level of rigor and quality of the text kids are reading. Delivering a generation of kids who can really read at that level is the hope and promise of this work.
Well, part of the conversation, it seems to me, is some default notion that rigor and critical thinking are the opposite of creative thinking. It seems as though part of the discussion and the conversation that's taking place posits that you're the enemy of creativity because you are demanding more rigor.
No, I consider, and I think most would, that the rigorous reading of high-quality stuff is an act of love. It's an act of appreciation. It's an act of caring about the choices an author's made. And that's true when reading the founding documents and the great conversation. It's true when reading a wonderful novel or a Shakespeare play to discuss when Hamlet actually enters the play is a wonderful question. Why did Shakespeare make this choice rather than another? So that's a rigorous conversation, but it's not a cold conversation.
Right. Specifically, what books, what texts have been used in the classroom that going forward you'll be happy to see taken off?
Really, no texts. I just want to be kind of clear with you that no texts are really excluded. Texts must be more demanding. So what there's going to be pressure against is watered-down versions of texts.
So I not being in the education world, what's an example of that, of a watered-down version of a text that a 10th or 11th grader will get instead of the real thing?
Oh, imagine if you were told that you're not going to read Shakespeare, but you'll read some summary version of it, or a kind of...
Really, like spark notes,
essentially?
Synopsis
of the play, exactly. Or you're not going to... You can't read the science textbook, right? It's too demanding for you. These standards insist that all kids have a right to encounter rigorous, rich text worth reading and examining.
It sounds like if you're a ninth grader who has been living in this softer, less demanding world of the last 10 years, this is bad news. You're in for a shock if the standards are going to.
Interesting you say that, because the fact is the bad news was true before. You were headed for remediation. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
In other words, that's the terrible truth, right?
Right.
The kid thinks they're okay.
Yeah. So this is just a reality check sooner.
It's the reality. And what's wonderful, is that the only way to get better at reading difficult things is to read them and explore them.
I still am, again, given how reasonable you sound and this sounds, why does somebody like Diane Ravitch, who is a knowledgeable authority in this world and has spent her life doing it, blogs and with a headline saying, "Why does David Coleman dislike fiction?" Why is that happening? Because unless you're lying to me, you don't dislike fiction.
To be rather frank, the most important fact for your listeners, Kurt, and the truth is that I've read the actual lines of the standards out loud. So it's important to make this not personal when it's not personal, meaning that it wouldn't really matter. I happen to love fiction, but more importantly, the standards do.
Yeah.
There are interesting debates to be had in this world. How to do it? How can we as a society, right, take a generation of children and successfully engage them in more demanding text in a way that's exciting and powerful for many more children? I think this other dispute is a rather false one, frankly.
Uh-huh. When you were a kid in school, was there a book that sort of made you open your eyes and go, "Whoa, this is not something I've experienced before"?
You know, it was Flowers for Algernon in 7th grade.
I'm sorry, it was what?
Flowers for Algernon. And I
which became the movie Charlie.
Yeah, exactly. And the teacher asked us to analyze the dreams. And there was no place to look for the answer to that question except to keep looking and figure out what clues were there, to kind of read like a detective. And I read it over and over. And it was that incredible experience of seeing more and more the more you looked. You know, that moment where a book becomes not just a one-dimensional thing, but a three-dimensional thing.
David Coleman, thank you very much for
talking
to me.
Thank you for this great conversation. Thank you so much.
David Coleman is president of the College Board and one of the authors of the Common Core State Standards, which have been adopted by almost every state and will go into effect in 2014. So, what do you think? Based on your experiences with the public schools in the last 10 or 20 years, Has the curriculum gotten dumbed down? Are students getting off too easy with what they're required to read and write? Let us know at studio360.org. This week, Vanity Fair magazine is publishing its first comedy-themed issue, an issue overseen by writer, director, producer, editor Judd Apatow. If you went to a film comedy in the last decade, it's a pretty good bet Apatow had something to do with it. He produced Bridesmaids, Anchorman, Get Him to the Greek, Pineapple Express, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Superbad, and wrote and directed 40-Year-Old Virgin, Funny People, and Knocked Up.
Isn't it weird, though, when you have a kid and all your dreams and hopes just go right out the window?
What changed for you? What went out the window? What plans? You do everything exactly the same.
No, I mean, I love what I'm doing. No, like, say, okay, say, you know, before you're married and have children, you want to go live in India for a year. You can do it, but you can't do it once you have a family.
You want to go live in India?
I don't want to go live in India.
Do you want to go to India? Go to India. Seriously. Go to India.
What about you? Do you want to go to India?
I'm not going to India. You can go to India.
Knocked Up was 5 years ago, and Judd Apatow's new movie is a kind of sort of sequel to it. Those secondary characters from that movie, Debbie and Pete, are the stars of This Is 40 as they turn 40 and deal with all that that generally implies. Judd Apatow, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here.
So Knocked Up had this high concept of this unintended pregnancy and marriage. This doesn't have a high concept. These main characters are totally typical, plausible, real-seeming yuppies to whom nothing very extraordinary occurs in the first act. In fact, I couldn't think of another big contemporary Hollywood movie of which that's true.
Life is complicated as it is. You don't need very much to happen to have a lot of problems and a nervous breakdown. We're all pretty overwhelmed just trying to be good parents and good spouses and to keep our health together and to deal with our families and to deal with our friends and our kids' schools. And it's just too much. And all the time, Leslie and I are saying to each other, how do people do it? Is everyone falling apart and having a meltdown from the pressure to do everything well?
And to get a sense of that, let's listen to a scene from This Is 40.
Another thing we've decided is to cut back on all of the electronics we use. Basically, what we're going to do is get rid of the Wi-Fi and only use the computer from 8 to 8:30 at night.
How are we going to go on the computer?
We're going to have a hard line in the kitchen.
Yeah, we'll supervise that.
You can't do this. You can't take away the Wi-Fi.
No Wi-Fi. Ha ha ha.
You don't spend enough time with the family when you're constantly on your iPhone and your computer. And, you know, you're only here for 5 more years.
So you won't see me after 5 years?
No, but you won't be living with us. And you should get to know your little sister.
You've got the perfect friend right here.
I don't want to be friends with her now. I'll be friends with her when she's 20, a normal person.
I don't want to hang out with her when I'm in my 20s.
So those are your actual daughters, Maude and Iris, playing these on-screen children, as well as your actual wife, Leslie Mann. How much of This Is 40 is autobiographical?
What's funny is, you know, nothing in it happened. It's not autobiographical in that sense, but it's emotionally accurate. It's everything we're struggling with. And we found a way to turn it into a story. So there are things in it that are specific. My kids have had terrible sibling rivalry. When they're performing scenes where they're mad at each other, they forget their cameras are there. They're actually pissed off at each other. They forget.
So they're like little Daniel Day-Lewis's, basically.
They really are. You know, Maude has some very emotional scenes. And, you know, when she has these scenes where she melts down and screams at her parents, it's pretty real. It's the things that upset her, and she could tap into it and show it.
Paul Rudd's bad habit, I think the only bad habit other than all of the normal, you know, evasions and not dealing with emotional realities that he has, is eating too many cakes.
Yes.
That's not a very bad habit.
It is if you could die from it. I mean, how my wife, deals with all of that is she'll just say, you're going to die. Your kids are going to have no dad based on eating a cupcake. Now, let me say this. My cholesterol has been over 300 at times.
Oh, really?
So I've pushed that as far as it can go. It's hard to be a comedy writer sitting in rooms for 11 hours and not go crazy on pizza and Chinese food. And at times I haven't taken seriously the idea that my arteries will harden.
You look fit enough for an apparently cereal cupcake eater.
Only from Leslie beating me down and refusing to allow me to drift off. And that is a fun thing that is in the movie, and those scenes are very funny, but it is based on a real thing, which is, are you going to take care of yourself for me? We have an agreement. We're partners, and we both should try not to die for each other.
We all have the same life, I guess.
Why do we fight?
I don't know. It makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
You get so mad at me.
Oh, my gosh.
I feel like you want to kill me.
I do want to kill you.
How would you do it?
I don't know. I poison you. I poison your cupcakes that you pretend not to eat every day. And just put, enough in to just slowly weaken you.
I love it.
I would enjoy our last few months together.
Me too.
Because you'd be so weak and, sweet, and I could take care of you, but while killing you.
See? You know what I love about us? You can still surprise me. I figured for sure you'd knock me out with one fell swoop of poison, but you would extend it over a series of months.
Have you ever thought about killing me?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Sure.
How would you do it?
Wood chipper.
A wood chipper?
Yeah.
A wood chipper?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. Did you see Fargo?
Yeah. Oh.
That's Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann whispering sweet nothings to each other. So you make this movie drawn from life, your family life, with your actual wife. You made it. You've cut it. It's coming out. It's out. Did it affect your marriage?
When I write Pete's point of view, a lot of the time, emotionally, it's my point of view. But also, I'm writing my weaknesses, and I'm pointing out to Leslie that I understand what's wrong with me, and I'm struggling with it. It's not just an argument against her. It's also saying, I know you think I don't get what a pain in the ass I am, but I am, because look, I wrote this whole scene about what a jerk I am.
Well, that's genuinely therapeutic, even if it solves nothing.
It is. There's something, I mean, maybe in a year or two after the movie, we could look back and think about, what it meant.
And then in 30 years, when you do your end of life elegiac thing, Paul Rudd can come along and do that too, I guess.
I love the idea of revisiting the same characters every 5 or 6 years forever.
So 7 Up, sort of, but done as fiction.
I love 7 Up, and the idea of trying to do that, I couldn't find more interesting. Right now, I say it a little bit as a joke to the actors, but I can't imagine that there's any chance that in 2 years I'm not trying to write it.
Yeah, this is 50.
Exactly.
My guest is Judd Apatow, who says he wants to keep making human comedies, comedies that feel like the movie Diner and the TV show Taxi. And my conversation with him continues in a minute here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, back now with the writer, director, producer Judd Apatow, who has been responsible for a plurality of Hollywood's most successful comedies of the last decade. His new movie, This Is 40, is about a marriage maybe on the brink. So you grew up in a marriage that ended. Your parents split up, and then your mom worked in a comedy club?
You know, my parents got divorced when I was in junior high school, and there was a summer where my mom was living in Southampton. And
fancy.
Well, not where she was living. There are less fancy aspects of it. And she got a job at a comedy club because my parents used to own a restaurant, and the bartender there was this guy named Rick Messina, and he opened up one of the first comedy clubs on Long Island, East Side Comedy Club. And then he opened another one called East End Comedy Club in Southampton. So as a favor, he gave her a job. Now, on some level, that was probably humiliating because this was like the bartender at the restaurant she owned giving her a job seating people at his comedy club. But I look back at it and I think she only took that job because she knew I loved comedy and I wanted to see the shows. So at 14 years old, I could go see Jay Leno and Paul Prevenza.
And you had already become a comedy geek and this just indulged that?
Yeah, I was a comedy geek, but I you know, other than seeing Don Rickles and Toadie Fields, I hadn't seen, you know, young stand-up comedians. So I look back at it as, you know, my mom giving me this gift. Because I can't imagine what she was getting paid to seat people at the comedy club. It couldn't have been anything, but it changed my life.
In retrospect, was your path forward clear to you then, or do you look back at that now and say, "Oh, that's that choice I made that led me here"?
I had no path. I just wanted to be Jerry Seinfeld or Jay Leno. That's all I wanted to do when I was a kid. How do I become a stand-up comedian? I didn't have a very clear idea what I would be beyond that. I'm sure I had some dream that I was going to become Bill Murray or Eddie Murphy, you know, some sort of movie star. But I hadn't thought it through. I just knew I had to get into that world. I didn't think at all about directing or writing. It wasn't a part of it. But I was so broke when I was a stand-up comedian that I needed to find a way to make money. So I started writing jokes for other comedians because any good comedian won't write for another comedian because they're trying to make their act great. They wouldn't expend energy or give away good jokes to someone else. But I needed cash, so I just did it. And then more and more people kept asking me to write their stand-up acts. And that led to jobs working, you know, writing jokes and making contributions to people like Roseanne and Tom. And
that's Roseanne Barr and Tom Arnold.
Yeah, and I thought they were one-namers by now.
Nobody's a one-namer.
And then I would write, you know, I wrote, you know, on the Grammys when Gary Shandling was hosting, and I helped Jim Carrey out with a comedy special he did. And then suddenly I was producing comedy specials, but really I was just writing jokes. And that led to meeting Ben Stiller and creating the Ben Stiller Show, the sketch show. So then suddenly writing had completely taken over, and I had to give up my stand-up career because I was just too busy making this sketch show to work on my act anymore and beginning to make good money as a writer, not money I was making, you know, doing a one-nighter in Rancho Cucamonga.
And you know, again, maybe you were also writing for and friends with people who didn't subsequently become huge, famous comedy stars. But it looks like, you know, the people you've mentioned and plus Adam Sandler and others, was it just talented people find each other, or are you sort of, you know, cherry picking the stars with whom you work?
Well, I did have very good taste. I was a gigantic comedy fan, still am, and I gravitated towards people who I thought were the best. So I did write for several people that, you know, didn't become gigantic stars, but for the most part, you know, I would see Jim Carrey doing stand-up at a comedy club before he was famous, and I would think, that's the funniest guy I've ever seen in my entire life. How could he not be the biggest star in the world? So you would meet them and get to know them and get hired to help out in some way, and he became a good friend of mine.
And I guess you had the self-awareness to say, he's better at that than I'll ever be.
I mean, literally, it was like trying to be a silent comedian next to Charlie Chaplin, and you would just give up and think, I think Chaplin's better than me. And that's the funny thing of doing stand-up, trying to be good at something, and the people you're doing it with are literally the best people who've ever done it.
We asked our listeners on Facebook if they had questions for you, and this is either can't lose or can't win, softball, hardball, I'm not sure. The question from Eric Winnick is, I'd like to know if he considers himself the voice of a generation.
to I consider myself the voice of a generation. Like Lena Dunham is the voice of a generation.
Who makes a joke, who is called that and makes a great joke about it in an early episode of Girls.
The voice of a generation. I don't think of myself as a voice of any generation. What I do think is that there's a type of comedy that I really like that I would like to see expand and continue, which is what I loved in movies like Diner and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Broadcast News, a human comedy, you know, All in the Family, Taxi. Those are the stories and the TV shows and the movies that imprinted me, and that's my favorite thing. I love a comedy that makes you, you know, root for people and root for people who are just trying to get through the normal aspects of life. I don't need someone trying to murder any of them for me to enjoy it. And so I'm trying to propagate that, I guess.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Diner and Broadcast News because those were funny movies, but that it seems the direction in which This Is 40 is going from your previous goofy comedies. Is this your Woody Allen evolution moment?
I'm enjoying getting closer to the truth, but at the same time, you know, I was one of the co-writers of You Don't Mess with the Zohan for Adam Sandler, and I couldn't have enjoyed that more. So there is a type of kind of hard comedy writing, which I value just as much. But mentally, I may need to do this just to figure stuff out.
Ted Apatow, thank you very much.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Judd Apatow is the writer and director of This Is 40, which opens later this month. We talked even longer, and you can hear the whole thing at studio360.org. And a reminder, Studio 360's latest listener extra credit project is in full swing. It is a challenge involving photo manipulation. Here's the deal. On our website, we provide 10 simple photographic elements, and it's up to you to use any tool you'd like, from Scotch tape to Photoshop, to create an original work of art and upload that image to us. In a few weeks, the two photographers who helped us launch that contest, Jerry Yulzman and his wife Maggie Taylor, will be back to choose the best pictures you've made. More than 200 of you have entered already.
My name is Andrea Little. I'm a graphic artist from Houston, Texas. I saw the man with the bowler on, and I thought, hey, he's pretty groovy. Let me work with him. So I wanted him as the background. And I actually wanted to take the wings off of the bird and put them somewhere in there. So I kind of cut those off the bird. Ah, God, that sounds bad. I ripped his wings off. And then I gave the guy some wings. And I said, oh, this is an old-fashioned picture. It needs a ghost. So I put the lady in there as a ghost. And I added the bust as a brooch on his little carnation on his lapel. And I said, you know, this is kind of looking very Terry Gilliam-esque. And I always think about that foot that he smashes things with on Monty Python. So I said, you know, I'm going to put that hand sticking out in the middle of nowhere and coming out of the frame. It's silly, it's fun, it's funky, it's quirky, and I love it.
And we want more of you to send us your funky, quirky compositions, but do it right away. The contest deadline is this Sunday, December 2nd at midnight. All the details for how to submit your entry are at studio360.org. Every year, the Library of Congress chooses 25 audio works to preserve in its National Recording Registry. And this month, we're highlighting a few of this year's. One of them is a psychedelic pop album from 1967. Nope, not Sgt. Pepper's. Forever Changes by the band Love. Like Sgt. Pepper's, it was a rock record with symphonic ambitions. Unlike Sgt. Pepper's, you've never heard of it or the band that made it. But among people who really know, Forever Changes is a forgotten masterpiece. Arthur Lee and Brian McLean, the main songwriters of Love, are no longer with us, so we'll hear about the making of the record from three others, starting with its producer.
Hi, this is Bruce Botnick. I recorded and produced Forever Changes for Elektra Records back in 1967.
My name is Johnny Eccles. I'm co-founder of the group Love and the lead guitar player in Forever Changes.
My name is Maria McKee. I'm Brian McLean's little sister. I was in a band called Lone Justice, and I've had a solo career. I love songs that start with yeah, just draws you right in.
Yeah, said it's all right. I won't forget all the times I've waited patiently for you. And you'll do just what you choose to do.
You can't even really make out who's singing the lead vocal. It could be Brian, it could be Arthur. And I think it's really about the atmosphere of the recording and what it represented.
Love was the first mixed race group out there. I mean, white guys and black guys.
We chose purposely to have a mixed racial group. We did not want to be typecast, and if we had had an all-black group, we would have been typecast as a blues group or an R&B group, and we didn't want that, so we purposely chose to have it multiracial.
And I will be alone again tonight, my dear.
Arthur Lee, the leader of the band, Brian McLean, guitar player, were both songwriters, but of course, Arthur was the leader.
Arthur Lee and his psychedelic band. Come on.
One, two, three, four.
Arthur Lee was a poet. He had a way of looking at life and putting it in words that were funny or that were profound.
Where are you walking? I've seen you walking. Have you been there before?
My brother Brian McLean joined the band when he was a teenager still, because he'd been on the road with the Byrds. He was the tour manager for the Byrds.
When he came into the group, we were kind of a rock blues band. So we basically flipped overnight to a folk rock group, and that was because of seeing the Byrds and also Brian's influence.
What Brian brought to the band was a sort of melodic sensibility that was fostered by his love of people like Leonard Bernstein and Stravinsky and Stephen Sondheim. He was really influenced by show tunes, and you know, and I think that that made the band unique.
I once knew a man, been everywhere in the world, gave me a tiny ivory ball, said it would bring me good.
It was a sort of Baroque period in L.A. when there was this really mystical sort of feeling. And, you know, L.A. has this incredible sort of gothic quality. It's this sort of haunted movie set. And that backdrop really, I think, sort of draws a certain type of artistic personality.
Arthur talked of death and resurrection and that war in Vietnam, which was on everybody's mind.
We're on the outskirts of the village of Cam Nhi with elements of the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. We were walking into this village when you can hear what happened.
We were playing in San Francisco, and an AWOL Vietnam soldier sat at the table with us, and he started telling us about the war. And he would tell us that when a soldier was bleeding and the blood mixed with mud, it would turn gray. And so that was one of the lines of the song, House is Not a Motel.
And the waters turn to blood, and if you don't think so, go turn on your tub. And if it's mixed with mud, you see it turn to gray. Then you can call my name. I hear you calling my name.
Our generation were listening to everything. There was sharing. To give you an example, when I was doing the Turtles, Happy Together, they were very close with the Beatles. and the Beatles had given them a monaural acetate reference disc of Sgt. Pepper months and months and months before it came out.
And everybody was so knocked out by that that we wanted to see if we could do something as good or better.
Not that we were trying to do Sgt. Pepper Forever Changes. It was not a financial success by any means. But, I mean, I've heard from quite a few musicians, especially English musicians, who adore the album, that grew up with it.
When I was in my band, Lone Justice, the first time we performed in London, that was pretty much all people wanted to talk about, really, was love.
This album, Forever Changes, epitomizes the period almost more than any album out there. I mean, without sounding dated.
The songs were poetry. You know, the music and the lyric fit beautifully together. It has a symbiotic relationship.
The fact that the band was a cultural melting pot, a multicultural band, is tremendous influence as well and really unique to this day. You don't see many bands like that.
And you juxtapose that with that war, and we were living in a really, really tense, chaotic time. And music was cathartic. It was something that allowed people to get away from that, to kind of step back. And because of the fact that those songs spoke to that, and it spoke to the younger generation, I think that's why it has held so long and is still selling after 40 years.
We heard from Johnny Eccles, Maria McKee, and Bruce Botnick talking about the album Forever Changes by the L.A. folk rock band Love. That 1967 recording has been preserved in the National Recording Registry. Our story was produced by Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich. And you can hear all our stories about pieces in the National Recording Registry, from Howlin' Wolf to Mel Brooks to Loretta Lynn, at studio360.org. In a minute, my conversation with the breakout Seattle rapper Macklemore.
I also come from the Catholic Church and the hip-hop community, which stereotypically are very homophobic communities. And I have two gay uncles and a gay godfather and was raised around gay men. So I have kind of these polar opposite upbringings, and I kind of merge those all together and put it into a record.
That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by The Gathering Ireland 2013, a year-long celebration of Irish music, fun, culture, and lots more. For those interested in uncovering their roots, renewing a love of Ireland, or discovering it for the first time. More information at discoverireland.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A few weeks ago, voters in Washington State approved a new state law legalizing marriage between people of the same sex. The campaign in favor had one unlikely and very vocal local supporter, the Seattle rapper known as Macklemore, who is straight and who's a somewhat unlikely rapper as well, I guess, since he's white. Macklemore wrote a beautiful song called Same Love, a ballad about gay marriage. And the Same Love video has been watched more than 7 million times on YouTube, more hits than there are people in the state of Washington.
But those that like the same sex have the characteristics. The right-wing conservatives think it's a decision, and you can be cured with some treatment and religion. Man-made rewiring of a predisposition, playing God. Oh, nah, here we go. America the brave still fears what we don't know. And God loves all his children. It's somehow forgotten, but we paraphrase a book written 3,500 years ago. I don't know.
Same Love is on Macklemore's new album, The Heist, made with producer Ryan Lewis. Macklemore and Ryan are on tour now. Ben Haggerty, a.k.a. Macklemore, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So, do you think Same Love, with its 7 million views, had any effect on this vote in Washington, which was a pretty close vote?
Yes, I do. To put an issue like same-sex marriage out there and to have a video that really gave a visual narration to it that connected with people on a personal, emotional level, I think that it did have
some... Make some people vote.
It made some people vote. You know, I don't want to take too much credit.
No, but the fact that you said yes makes me... as if I already wasn't predisposed to like you rather than saying, well, no, I don't know. Good for you.
Thank you.
For owning a little bit of it.
We were aware of it. We knew it was going to be a tight race.
Yeah.
And it was an important issue for me personally. And to watch the people's reaction, people whose lives were affected by the song, personal testimonies and emails that we were getting, I would be almost too humble to downplay
right.
some of the power in the record.
Rappers have, for the last 30 years, not been known for endorsing gayness in their lyrics,
I don't know, ever.
Right. So at what point did you decide, I need to do this?
I watched so many records receive critical acclaim that were very derogatory to homosexuals. That and misogyny are still kind of the two very acceptable means of oppression in terms of hip-hop culture. And it's 2012. There needs to be some accountability. I think that as a society, we are evolving, and I think that hip-hop has always been a representation of what's going on in the world right now. My mother sent me a newspaper article. A 13-year-old kid killed himself over being called faggot in school. And that was kind of it for me. I realized it was an epidemic. I realized that this needs to be addressed. I started writing it from the perspective of this gay bullied kid. I played it for my producer, Ryan Lewis, and he immediately was like, you know what, this is good, but this isn't your story, and you have a story. And my story is I'm from Seattle, Washington, a very liberal part of the city, Capitol Hill, and I also come from the Catholic Church and the hip-hop community, which stereotypically are very homophobic communities. So, and I have two gay uncles and a gay godfather and was raised around gay men. So I have kind of these polar opposite upbringings, and I kind of merge those all together and put it into a record.
There is no difference. Live on and be yourself. When I was at church, they taught me something else. If you preach hate at the service, those words aren't anointed. That holy water that you soak in has been poisoned. When everyone else is more comfortable remaining voiceless rather than fighting for humans that have had their rights stolen. I might not be the same, but that's not important. No freedom till we're equal. Damn right I support it.
Did you get any or much backlash, surprised reaction?
The surprising reaction was that there wasn't much backlash. If you read YouTube comments, you can see hateful comments all day long on any one of our videos, but particularly this one. But in terms of the hip-hop community, which I was immediately the most concerned about, how are my peers going to react to this? How are the people that I maybe want to collaborate with one day or hope to collaborate with? Am I going to be exiled? And, you know, you put it on a scale. And I think that the minute that you're scared, the minute that you're afraid is the minute that you're standing up for the right issue.
Yeah. Another one of your songs, which is very different and huge fun. Last time I looked yesterday, it was approaching 20 million views on YouTube. This is Thrift Shop.
I'ma take your grandpa style. I'ma take your grandpa style. No, for real. Ask your grandpa, can I have his hand-me-down? Velour jumpsuit and some house slippers. Dookie brown leather jacket that I found. Dig it. They had a broken keyboard. I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket. Then I bought a kneeboard. Hello, hello, my ace man, my mellow. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game. Hell no. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads would be like, ah, he got the Velcro.
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is awesome. Ow. I'm gonna pop some tags.
That's a delightful song. And you know, in rap lyrics especially, we're used to hearing kind of rags to riches stories. This is rags to cool rags.
Some more rags, yeah.
Yeah. Were you surprised that this song in particular caught on so big?
You know what? I am. I was and I still am. I mean, they're playing it on pop radio stations all over the country now. I didn't expect to have any sort of success with radio, much less thrift shop. I knew that it was catchy. I knew that the subject matter was fun. I thought it was going to be a very niche demographic, and that niche demographic has turned into kind of a more pop culture demographic.
And there's an interesting idea embedded in it, an idea I've written about a lot, which is that old things are perpetually these days being recycled into new, cool things, right?
Absolutely.
It's not just the thrift shop. It's a
absolutely
bigger idea.
Yeah, and like you said, it's so different than what we normally hear about. I mean, we're in hip-hop culture constantly being told to buy Louis Vuitton and buy Prada and buy this Lamborghini and buy this mansion, and it really stuck out.
The first song on this album is called 10,000 Hours, which is a reference to our friend Malcolm Gladwell's idea that it takes 10,000 hours to practice something to achieve mastery. Do you feel like that was true in your case as a rapper?
It's taken me a long time. This wasn't something that I picked up and 6 months later I was good at. It took me many, many, many years. I don't know how close I am to 10,000. I got to be close. I got to be somewhere close to it. But yeah, I think that it comes down to dedication. And I really had that at an early age. This is the only thing that I did. I kind of gave up sports. I gave up really a social life to work on music.
And when you were, let's say, at hour 400 or 500, were you aware that, like, I'm not good enough yet?
I had a mom that was really good at lying to me. So she would, you know, anything that I did was, oh, my God, that's so amazing. Yeah. And I had no idea how horrible I was. And I was horrible.
And were there points along the way, I mean, you were not an overnight success, where you felt like chucking it and trying to, you know, get your teaching credentials?
Yeah, I was close. You know, more so than anything, it came down to drugs and alcohol. And that was my real barrier in terms of being successful. I always had this faith that if I can get sober for long enough, I can make an album. And with that album, I will be able to live off of this album.
I want to play a little bit of your song, Awake, which is two words, awake.
My subconscious telling me stop it. This is an issue that you shouldn't get involved in. Don't even tweet RIP Trayvon Martin. Don't want to be that white dude, million man marching. Fighting for a freedom that my people stole. Don't want to make all my white fans uncomfortable. But you don't even have a fucking song for radio. While you out here talking race, trying to save the fucking globe. Don't get involved if the cause isn't mine. White privilege, white guilt at the same damn time. So we just party like it's 1999. Celebrate the ignorance while these kids keep dying.
So that's tough. Does that make your white fans uncomfortable?
Race is a tricky issue. And it's something that I have really tried to delve into, acknowledging my white privilege, acknowledging where, you know, a large portion of my fan base comes from, and trying to break it down. It's holding myself accountable in terms of the music that I'm making now, because I know how to make a pop song. I know how to make a song that's going to make people dance. I know how to write lyrics that don't challenge the listener or myself at all. Those songs can be really fun to write, but there's bigger issues at hand, and I want to delve into those. Those are more important in terms of cultural moments, defining like what this means to be alive in 2012 and taking an analytical approach. That's who I want to be.
Ben Haggerty, it was a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me.
Macklemore's record is called The Heist. He and his producer Ryan Lewis are on tour right now, and you can hear him talk about how he ended up with the name Macklemore and see the video for his hit Same Love on our website, studio360.org.
I hope the guy decides to talk through if the people decide to walk with them, regardless of pitchfork, cosigns, I'll jump. Make sure the sound man doesn't block the drums. Let the snare knock the air right out of your lungs. And those words be the oxygen. Just breathe, amen. Regardless, I'ma say it. Felt like I got signed the day that I got an agent. Got an iTunes check, man, I'm parent. About damn time that I got out of my basement. About damn time I got around the country and I hit these stages. I was made to slay them. 10,000 hours, I'm so damn close, I can taste it. Also, Malcolm Gladwell, David Bowie meets Kanye. This is dedication. A life lived for art is never a life wasted. 10,000.
That's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget, Sunday at midnight is the deadline for our photo remix contest. All the information on how to enter is at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Leibowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
Thanks as always to Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Our series on the National Recording Registry receives support from the Library of Congress.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? By Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
Slap it to bass.
That sounded like Borat.
Yeah.
Slap it to bass. Big time.
That's better.
The actor Paul Rudd has a secret weapon, insecurity.
I would say there's been a very awkward thread through a lot
true.
Of the stuff that I've
that's
done
true.
Recently. And that's because that's the way I feel many times throughout my day.
Paul Rudd, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.